and welcome to, my God, season 7 of Refigure Podcast, a lovely podcast made at home about culture and the arts, and also a bit about things like tech and diversity and the planet and shit like that.
Representation.
All of that stuff. Season 7, it's spring 2024.
With me, Reefa.
And me, Chris. How are you doing, Reefa?
Very well, thank you. I feel like a new energy has come since the solar eclipse has beamed all across America, which means obviously they're going to have a massive breakthrough and come to their senses, all the Americans that are running things there. And certainly I'm really glad that we're back on it with this podcast that prods people to go and do some cultural things.
I think we might do one episode every 2 weeks.
Well, logistically, I don't think it matters to our listener. They don't mind. They just catch up when they can.
Okay.
So you go for it. What are we going to talk about today, Mr. Chris?
What are we going to talk about today? First, we're going to talk about the exhibition of Yoko Ono retrospective at the Tate Modern. I think it's called Music of the Mind, and it's runs through till September. We'll also talk about Shogun miniseries adaptation. We're watching it on Disney. Is it on Disney? Yeah, Disney TV series.
Excellent.
And we'll do What You're Reading For, like we always do as well.
Yeah. What have you been up to, Chris?
Lots of writing, lots of sitting at home, tearing my hair out, trying to write. I went and saw, without Reefa, I went and saw Maggie Rogers, the brilliant pop singer, who's sort of taking a kind of more Americana direction. Saw her do an acoustic show. What else have we seen?
Well, I really loved Lime Garden, and it was a really odd way of me finding out about them. I think I overheard somebody talking about their girlfriend's band in a coffee shop, and they didn't even say the word Lime Garden, but it's like lime as in the fruit, okay, and garden, but it sounds a little bit like Lady Garden. So I was like, oh, let me he didn't even say the freaking name. It was just me thinking, oh, Brighton based band, they got a record out, da-da-da, I have no idea. And also they're on So Young record label, So, which has a magazine all over the country. And I picked it up, and they're in that, the last issue before last. Just listened to the album on repeat, and it was like, you know, how I get with some albums where I can't stop listening to it. And they've got some real earwormy songs on there. And then they were playing in Brighton like that weekend. So I dragged Chris along. He really didn't want to go. You liked Ugly, who were on before them. And it was absolutely ram-jammed at Chalk. I had such a lovely time jumping around at the front with lots of people who were sort of my height and a little bit younger than me. And I had such a fun time because they really play their instruments well, they're really fun, and they have a lot of swagger. And it's for young women from Brighton, which can't be bad.
Yeah, I really liked the band Ugly that opened for them, but Ugly's quite a rubbish name for the band.
Well, it is.
But we are in a different era of band names, aren't we? Like,
we're Googling
bands
have
it. All the weirdest names now. And what you'd imagine is that bands now would have names that can't be anything else other than their band. And some bands do that, like Churches, where they spell it with a V. There's lots of bands like that, where they kind of find a combination of letters that won't be anything else. But at the same time, there also seems to be loads of bands who have just picked some completely common word that anyone would use. And Ugly is an example of that.
They could at least have had two G's.
Yeah, or spelt it Eggly or something, but no.
Igly. Idly. Idlies are those little rice cakes that you get. Anyway.
That would be a good name. That's a better name for a band than Ugly.
Idly.
Yeah.
No, if you try to Google Idly, that would be silly.
Yoko Ono, Music of the Mind, is at Tate Modern. Pretty vast exhibition, trailblazing kind of conceptual and performance artist and kind of participatory artist. So one of the things that Yoko Ono is famous for is she would set up something where you take part. For example, sitting in a place where, and then encouraging you to come and cut bits of her clothing off her with scissors and stuff, and so the audience would each cut away a little bit of cloth until she hasn't got any clothes on. Or like a massive canvas with a hole in it where you're supposed to shake hands through the hole. And there's lots of these ideas. I think we had quite different reactions to this. So I was totally blown away by this and loved it much more than I was expecting. But you were a bit nonplussed. So what did you think of it?
All I really know, this is going to sound super ignorant, all I really know about Yoko Ono is she's Japanese, she married a Beatle, there's a band called the Beatles, she married John Lennon. People absolutely, in Britain, absolutely hated her for all different reasons, but mostly because she married a Beatle, and Beatle wives always got loads of flack in the 60s, 70s, 80s. All I knew of her really was that she was an experimental artist. So I weirdly thought there might be some paintings? Paintings. I actually thought there might be something else, that she wasn't a situational artist. So, you know, the famous things I know of are things that she did with John Lennon, like the Lovin', you know, where they stayed in bed for like a week or something in protest, or they put a hoarding of like War Is Over. So there's things that I know, but obviously it's way before my time and I don't really know much about her work. So I went with a sort of, I don't know, I wasn't in the right mood, and I was a bit surprised because sometimes you're not in the right mood for this sort of thing.
Fair point,
like
yeah.
Yaya Kusumi had a room where you could go in and put a dot, like a physical dot in a white room. And you were like, I'm not into it. I don't want to get to go in and put a dot on her when that was on. And she has some situational stuff, you know, things that are Instagrammable. But she also has sculpture. She also has other things that you can look at. But her theme is dots, okay? Whereas this is like, there's a humour. It's almost Dadaist, her humour. You've got to be in a certain mood for that sort of thing. So when I walk in a room and also we've gone like quite far, like it's been open for some time. So by the time we've gone to see it and there's a wall where it says the instructions are, bang a nail in the wall and see what happens, right? There's already like a million other nails have already been driven in the wall. I'm like, and I didn't really get her sense of humour. However, I read in the Tate magazine, they have a piece with lots of people like Anhony and Viv Albertine and people like that talking about the impact that Yoko Ono has had on their lives, right? And obviously, you know, I don't want to be an arsehole about this. I want to actually understand a bit more about her work. It's just at the time, it was kind of not, I wasn't in the mood for it. There's a lot going on in the world, and sometimes you don't really feel like watching other people be an idiot in a space. So Viv Albertine gave a little story in the account about how when she was 16, her and her mates all really loved this book, Grapefruit, that Yoko Ono wrote, and it's pretty much the exhibition in a book, in a little book. So I got the little book, and I'm going to talk about this in what you're reading for, but she explained, you know, that it really touched her, and it's really punk, and it's really DIY, and it's really superficial on one level, but really deep on another level, and it's all about play. So for example, when John Lennon first encountered Yoko Ono, he went up a really, really high ladder. That was the experiment in this gallery. Go up a very, very high ladder and then look at the ceiling and get the message. And the message is written really tiny at the top. And it was a really positive message. And he was really moved by it because he thought, if I go up this ladder, there's something really negative, I'm not going to be really happy about this at all. And that's probably what made him fall in love with her in the first place. And they had this most intense relationship. What did you think about it, Chris?
Well, first thing is how long her career is and that she's still going and making art now. And she's 91, born in the 30s. Yoko Ono was already active as an artist from the mid-50s onwards. That's way before John Lennon gets going. You almost get the sense when you look at this whole exhibition as a sort of thing that although John Lennon is a very big presence in her life, that's a blink of an eye. And her work is so much more vast than I was imagining. I also sort of thought, had lots of preconceptions about her, I think. All of the interactive stuff I found either really amusing, like either just funny and cute and silly, or in some cases really unexpectedly provocative in a really interesting way. And she was doing a lot of this stuff first. So I have a lot of skepticism about, say, Marina Abramovich. Yeah. She does a lot of intense stuff where she'll, you know, sit in a room and people will come and sit opposite her. And it's all, it can be really great. It can be really powerful. But what Yoko Ono was doing was really at the pioneering forefront of that kind of art. But at the same time, it's full of ideas. And that's the other thing, maybe about the book, about Grapefruit as well. But one of the things that's in this exhibition that I wasn't expecting is long lines of postcard-sized little things on the wall. And each one is an art idea. And it reminded me of Brian Eno's approach to, like write your ideas down. Because even if there isn't the sort of space or the time to create an exhibit about this idea, the idea in and of itself has that value. So you could almost ignore all the big pieces and just spend an hour walking around the walls, reading these quirky, often really sort of quite transformative ideas. So I think the reason my sort of skepticism was overwhelmed was that those ideas and some of the kind of micro content is just really rich and really thought-provoking. Now, the bit I'm not so into, I find her piece stuff, which is probably really important, a little boring. And what she does in the later part of her career, post The Bed-In and post Lennon, and especially more recently, as she's become in some ways stuck in this role of a sort of holding of this incredible huge legacy of Yoko and John, and all of this stuff that sits on that Give Peace a Chance and Imagine and all this stuff. And I find this kind of, oh, here's a tree with a load of things on for peace, put a message for peace on it. While it is really, I agree with it all ideologically, it just often strikes me as a little bit kind of twee and annoying. I mean, this is something we might talk about episode after episode, or we might not talk about it at all, but quite a lot of our cultural experiences in the past few months and ongoing are refracted through this lens of we're witnessing some horrible things in the world, particularly
again,
but more vividly witnessing them live and seeing them. That sort of changes one's vibe about something like this, because people should be speaking out now about a certain issue. And then if they aren't, one kind of, I'm not going to say this very well, but one sort of ends up judging in a way one shouldn't. And not even judging the art for what it is, but worrying about the absences in it. I mean, that's not a specific comment about Yoko Ono, but it's about everything I've consumed in the last 5-6 months. But so many ideas, beautifully rendered, it's beautifully curated, they give her the space. It's an important exhibition to go and see, I think.
Yeah, it is. And hopefully I'll get to go and see it again when I'm in a different mood. Right. Also, the merch could have been a lot better, because I am terrible at art merch. Like, if there was like Yoko Ono and the O's went over my boobs t-shirt, I'd probably wear that.
Great.
And we're in a phase now of archiving, like bringing out stuff, and like it's an archive. And there was one room in particular which was like a listening room that they'd made a sort of set of a record shop with all her albums, which I was quite impressed by, actually. The volume of music that she's put out, or let's per se vinyl records that she's put out of her warbling, is pretty good, I thought. But she's an amazing icon, so it's worth seeing her work on the walls.
I loved the white chess set, which was great. She laid out lots of these chess sets and you could go and play with someone, and they were all white pieces, so therefore once you've played a few moves, you start to get muddled up over which side is which.
And therefore, what a good metaphor. In another context, you'd have gone, oh, that's a bit on the nose, reefer, isn't
I'm
it?
I'm sure I would, yeah.
And been a bit pompous about it. I always find it really interesting when you've got, like when we went to see the Basquiat at the Barbican, it's like you've got these really wildly experimental artists, but they're still obviously in the confines of a white space because people. So you've still got, you know, guards making sure that you don't nick something or throw something on the floor or smash the glass or do something. But that's not what this is about, you know. It's not an art house. It's an exhibition. So that is Yoko Ono, Music of the Mind at the Tate Modern. It's open until the 1st of September. Go and see it. So continuing with the Japanese theme, it's a bit nebulous, but you know, All right, you
Shall I do the Wikipedia bit?
You do it.
Okay, so Shogun is a new historical drama series created by Rachel Kondo and Justin Marks, and it's based on this 1975 novel by James Clavell that was a big hit novel at the time, but even more famously was then adapted into a very glamorous, sexy miniseries in 1980 starring Richard Chamberlain. That series has not aged well at all. And
I remember seeing it when I was a kid, and I really shouldn't have. It's steamy, man.
Yeah, but also, with hindsight, it was
pretty
racist.
It's really racist. Like everything in the 80s.
Yeah, like everything, basically. So now we have a kind of much, in theory, much more progressive, even though it's technically an American series. It's
all Japanese actors. It's historically more accurate. And it's mostly in Japanese with subtitles. Where can people watch it, Chris? What are we watching?
It's on Disney Plus.
Why do you like it so much?
Basically, there's an English sailor who's shipwrecked in Japan.
The Japans.
That coincides with a huge power struggle among the shogunate, which is, so the nominal king, the shogun, has died, and there's a little kind of clique of five people who've been charged with looking after the country until his heir comes of age, but they're all fighting amongst themselves. And it's the one we sort of are associated with watching is Lord Toranaga, and the Englishman is John Blackthorne. And so these two, it's about their relationship, and also a woman called Lady Mariko, who is tasked with being the interpreter because she speaks English. And it's a bilingual series, so all the Japanese stuff is in Japanese with subtitles, and we get, really the only English we get is when this chap is trying to learn and stuff.
And what time frame is it in? The 1500s?
And later, it's set in the early 1600s.
Yeah. So for me, why I love it is that it's this historical drama. It's really quite dark, and it's also very beautifully filmed. And I'm assuming, because I can only go on what I see, it's historically correct with all the kind of culture and rituals and conventions that the Japanese upper classes have. But we also see how people in the kind of feudal system that they have operate as well. So even when they're surrendering, or they've taken other people hostage, or they're fighting amongst themselves, there are rules to engagement. There are rules where they don't want to lose face. I mean, the whole thing kicks off with somebody making a massive faux pas and literally having to commit suicide and kill their own heirs and kill pretty much all their family. So it's pretty violent, but it's also fascinating and just sometimes really slow, but also really deep and impactful as well, because some of these romantic things that we think about Japanese culture, the way courtesans work, the way women are in the society, the way they dress, the way they move, the clothes that they wear, the conventions about how they live and what they eat even, is brought really starkly to bear when you've got what they consider a barbarian, a Portuguese person.
No, he's British. But there are, the only other white people in Japan at the time are the Catholics. Portuguese Catholics.
Yes, sorry, I'm getting muddled up. So that's what's interesting for me, because their culture, their way of life is so refined and exquisite that the unrefined sailor is a stark contrast to that. What do you think about it, Chris?
I have mixed feelings about it. I have enjoyed it. Maybe it's one of those shows where the production design and the money and the opulence of it and how beautifully authentic it kind of looks and just the exoticism of this historic place kind of outguns the actual story and some of the performances. What I'm actually getting out of it is more like a soap opera.
But that's the book, isn't it? That's the actual content.
We watched Blue Eye Samurai, which is an adult animated drama series on Netflix, which is about a very similar period. In fact, it's set probably only 30 years later or earlier. I can't remember which way round it is. It's also got an underpinning about the relationship between Japan and when it was closed off to the wider world, and how white people specifically who got into Japan interacted with the Japanese culture at that time. So Blue Eye Samurai is about someone who's a Japanese young person who is brought up to be a warrior, but has an absent father who is one of these white people, and it's this source of incredible shame. Blue Eye Samurai is a masterpiece, and we were absolutely transfixed by it. It's a bit slow-paced, but apart from that, it looks stunning in a similar way to Shogun. It's animated, so a lot of people who will watch Shogun won't even encounter Blue Eye Samurai, because there's a whole load of adults out there that don't watch animated, don't watch cartoons like that. For me, Blue Eye Samurai had all the kind of intensity of meaning and nuance and layered stuff. For me, Blue Eye Samurai was a much, much better show. What did you think of Blue Eye Samurai?
No, I loved it too, but I have... No, I thought it was good. I thought it was really good. I liked the fact there were so many different levels and nuances in it, you know, to do with race and gender, and how the fact that the main character's got blue eyes, is the blue-eyed samurai, was seen as like almost like a freak, completely like bizarre thing in this closed off culture where nobody has blue eyes. Of course, there's lots of very on the nose analogies with that, because the culture's so different. Yeah, it's super violent and it's a very adult anime, you know, and it's not for kids. But yeah, I did really enjoy it. All good. Moving on.
What are you reading for? What are you reading for?
What are you reading for? What are you reading for?
What are you reading for?
What are you reading for, Reefa?
So I ordered, because of Viv Albertine's review of this book, Grapefruit, a book of instruction and drawings by Yoko Ono, with an introduction by somebody called John Lennon. It's so interesting for me because I know millennials who have heard of the Beatles, but they don't never really listen to any of their songs. And I remember being a bit like that myself until I listened to Revolver. And so it's a funny one. Well, basically, it's a little yellow book. It was written in 1964. This edition, it's from 2000. It was reprinted, obviously. And it's got a new foreword by Yoko Ono. So it's basically lots of little instructions. So just one is like, I've just opened it at random, and it was written in 1964, spring. Mirror piece. Instead of obtaining a mirror, obtain a person. Look into him. Use different people. Old, young, fat, small, etc. It's super cute, but also very profound. And it's got a few of her little... There are some visual art in there as well, and these little doodles I absolutely love. And this weekend I went on what's called a wild painting retreat with a bunch of women, and run by a woman in Brighton called Moira Scott. She's running them every season, and she talks about gestural painting and work, you know, paint to music, and don't worry about the mistakes, and keep painting, and just keep doing it. And I did my best piece of art yet. And it was kind of a massive doodle, but I did it in paint and I'm into it. So you can look at that, dear listener, on my Instagram, at Reefa. What are you reading for, Chris?
Joel Morris's book.
Whoop!
Be Funny or Die.
Is it funny?
Which is an analytic book about comedy, deconstructing the ideas of comedy and
gags,
explaining why comedy works, how it works, and how to do it. If that sounds a bit dry, it's not. It's actually a very funny book. I should straight away say that I know Joel. He's an old friend. It's still, I would say, one of the finest books I've ever read, taking apart the creative arts and looking at how they work, one bit of creative arts. I do love an artistic analysis, I've realised. I know I wrote one. I wrote all my song lyrics in and annotated those. But I have realised I just really love, I don't mind. So one of the things that Joel says through the book is this problem of, if you start to analyse comedy, obviously it's not funny, you're killing the frog. And he actually manages to sort of kill his frogs in an amusing fashion all the way through. Given that I've been doing performing arts, obviously not comedy, but I've been writing and performing for 25 years, and there was still such insight in there that I hadn't thought about or hadn't put into place. It's a fantastic instructional if you are writing anything, not just comedy. It's a funny book, it's really thought-provoking book. And he also does something that I was so impressed by, which is that he engages with the current cultural problems of comedy and the challenges of punching down, or comedy that alienates, or racism, or misogyny, or various issues with it that are particularly prevalent in the comedy world right now. And he manages to analyse those and look at why those work when they work and when they don't work, and what's actually going on. And he does the whole thing without being offensive himself, but also without sort of backing away from the topic. And I found that whole chunk of the book inspiring. It's quite, I would say courageous, but writing a book about comedy isn't courageous. But the bit where you could go, oh, I'll just leave that alone. He doesn't just dive in. He's really carefully thought his way through walking through that particular garden of comedy. Great. So that's Joel Morris, Be Funny or Die, out now in hardback.
Yeah. Awesome. And that's our show.
That wasn't bad for a sort of first go. So we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Bye for now.
If you're enjoying it, please tell your friends. Where can you find us online, Reefa?
We have an Instagram, Refigure UK.
That'll do.
That'll do.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now. Fly up.